on Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for being with us tonight. We have a treat tonight. It's always nice to hear what Larry Dossey has to say. He always has wonderfully interesting things to tell us about. And tonight we're going to talk about his new book, One Mind. Dr. Dossey, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, it's just great to be on your show again, Eva. Thanks for the invitation.
Certainly. So before we get started, why don't you tell people where they can find you and get a copy of this book and any of your other books that you've put out there?
Well, this book is in all major bookstores, and people otherwise can go to my website and click on the book, and the website is www.larrydosseymd.com, and that's D-O-S-S-E-Y.
So tell us, just for people who may hear of you, you know, first time, tell us a little bit about you before we get started. Why do you have some expertise in what we're going to talk about?
Well, I hope I do. I have spent most of my adult life in the practice of internal medicine in Dallas, Texas, and beginning in the 1980s, I began to write about the role of consciousness and health and healing. And this is my 12th book, which in one way or another, Eva, explores the connections between spirituality, spiritual practices, and health and longevity. I think that this is a great time to be alive and to be exploring this area, because there is so much information coming out now about things that we just previously couldn't talk about. When I was a young doctor, you just didn't talk about the role of consciousness in anything. But, you know, this is a new era, and we have so much on the table now that it's really a wonderful time to be exploring these issues, as I'm sure you know.
So before we go into this, you bring us that word, and you know what I think about consciousness. I have lots of things to say about that. What is that thing?
If I could give you a proper definition, I'd probably be awarded a Nobel Prize. Consciousness is what you and I are doing right now. It's being aware. It's part of consciousness is the expression of emotions and thoughts and feelings, such as we're exchanging now with anyone who is listening. But consciousness goes farther than that. Most of the great traditions have considered consciousness to be the foundation for awareness. It's what makes awareness possible. It's infinite. It's not restricted to our brains and our bodies, or even to the present moment, for that matter. And so it's a fundamental principle that pervades the universe. You will not find that definition in textbooks of psychiatry, but it's one that is consistent with most of the esoteric sides of all the major traditions for the past 4,000 years.
I'd like to, a while back, you wrote an endorsement for my book, Consciousness. I don't know if you remember, but you did. And one of the goals of that book is to bridge the gap with scientists. So if you could say one thing to scientists, because as you know, scientists often argue, heated arguments about their research or what that thing is, what would you say to them what would be a thing to bridge that gap in linguistically?
Well, I have a three-word piece of advice for scientists who want to study this area, and it's just simply do good science. Most of the people I run into in science and in medicine who obstruct this idea of a one mind, an infinite reach of the mind, simply are extraordinarily poorly informed about the research that's important in this area. I can honestly say that I have never met a skeptical scientist toward these issues who has even read the relevant experiments which shed light on this area. So
totally
I would just say, you know, do good science, and we can talk about the experiments and what the science looks like, but the dialogue, the conversation never goes anywhere as long as just one of us is informed about the relevant data.
So your book, One Mind, let's talk about that. What is mind? And I know we're going to need to talk about a couple of different definitions, so if you just want to go ahead and go there. What is that thing?
Well, I use, intentionally, I use mind and consciousness interchangeably in the book. And my reason for doing that is that I think that people's eyes sometimes glaze over, if, particularly in Western cultures, if we get too strung out on extremely picky, precise definitions. I think people can understand what I'm talking about in context in this book. But briefly, just to state it again, consciousness is the huge umbrella under which awareness and mind fit. So that's basically my position.
Okay, that sounds good to me. So the next question that I want to ask is, what do you believe to be the source? You talk about this in your book, you bring it up, so I'm just kind of skipping around, but what is the source of creativity or the source of intention, and what does that have to do with one mind?
Well, I think creativity occurs sometimes dramatically and majestically when people tap into what I call the one mind. And the one mind is a unitary idea where all consciousnesses come together. The one mind is what happens when all of our individual minds connect. I think that's the best model to explain breakthroughs in creativity, sudden explosions of wisdom in people's lives who could not possibly have learned what it is that they're trying to express. Religious and spiritual epiphanies where people just feel caught up in something greater than their individual self, something wiser than the individual mind. And in the book, I talk about a lot of the ways that this awareness of the one mind expresses itself. There are a million ways that people can access and apprehend this idea of a collective consciousness. And indeed, I think it's very difficult not to do it because it's so universal and speaks to us in so many ways that it's hard not to get some sort of inkling that we're part of something larger than our individual consciousness.
So do tell. Do tell us how some of those ways are expressed. And tell us, are you basing these statements on theory or fact or both?
Well, there are two sides to it. One is experience. People have been talking about and setting down these experiences only for about 5,000 years. But what we have going for us now is not just experience. We have experiments which point in the same direction. I got interested in this experimental aspect of how consciousness is infinite and not confined to individuals back in the 80s when studies in intercessory prayer and healing began to be published in peer-reviewed major medical journals. And just to be quite brief about this, these studies pointed to the fact that consciousness is not confined to our individual brains and bodies, not even to the present moment. It can reach out through intention, through intentionality, through willing, wishing, wanting, and so on, at a distance to change other people's health status. There are about 25 major controlled studies now that show that this is the case. And so what I was faced with and what a lot of consciousness researchers have bumped into is the need to develop a new picture of what consciousness is. And I can tell you it ain't the one that you and I were taught about when we were in biology classes in medical school and university. The message that we got and really were almost hypnotized by because it was so incessant was the idea that the brain somehow makes consciousness. Nobody has ever seen that happen. There's not even a good theory how it could happen. And so it's sort of neuromythology, as I call it, but that's the going picture of our mind, that it's produced by the brain, it's confined to our individual brains and bodies, and it can't stray outside the present. Now, this is where the experiments come in, Eva, because the experiments point like an arrow to the fact that that's not a correct view of the mind. It can reach out at a distance, even at global distances, and make a difference in other people's lives, their health status, and a heck of a lot of other ways as well.
I'm curious. I interviewed a physicist last week, Henry Stapp, about his new book, and I don't have the right name because it's not out yet, but at the draft of it, it's The Mind-Like Universe, Why the World Must Be Fundamentally Mind-Like and Not Matter-Like. However, when we got towards the end of the interview, he went into the neurologist, you know, and mind being brain a little bit. Not completely, but a little bit. So what do you say to these neurologists who are insistent that mind is brain?
Well, I have a whole section in my book on that. And I know Professor Stapp, and I really honor him. And I have a quote in the book that by Professor Stapp. He says that that consciousness can do things in the universe. It can reach out beyond the brain and the present and actually cause a change in the state of the physical world. Now, when people like Dr. Stapp start talking neuropsychiatry and neurology and neurobiology, you think, well, you know, they're just backtracking. They're taking it all back now because they're saying brain really equals mind. I think that we can learn a lot from brain chemistry and brain biology and anatomy and so on. But the model has to be changed about the connection between brain and mind. I quote all sorts of high-powered neurologists in the book who believe that our mind, our consciousness, works through the brain, sort of like the signal works through our television set. But the brain doesn't make mind. It doesn't manufacture consciousness like the liver makes bile or something like that. And this idea that the brain serves as a conduit or a transmitter of consciousness but doesn't produce it is, I think, the picture, the image of consciousness that's going to prevail. People like Rupert Sheldrake, Peter Finnick, Dean Radin, and many eminent people who are involved in consciousness researchers really like this idea of the brain as sort of a transmitter or conduit. And as a matter of fact, the person who really probably was most famous in the 20th century, he believed this point of view, was William James, the father of American psychiatry. So I think that people who really think that consciousness can be accounted for by brain chemistry are really chasing a ghost that just doesn't have any hope of paying off for them.
When you talk about brain and mind, you also have to talk about thought. What is thought?
Well, I don't have I would equate thought basically with what you and I are doing right now. You know, we think about something and we articulate it, and thought is something that stands behind language. I think that's a pretty proper definition. Cognition is a term that psychologists use that might stand in for thought. But I wouldn't want to separate thought from mind. I think thought is some of the stuff that we associate with the actions of consciousness, of mind, such as emotions, feelings, and as you say, thought.
So I'm going to jump a little bit here. It's been established, many claim that's been established. I'm not a scientist, so I'm just talking here. But it's been established that thought can change our reality, or intention, whatever word that you want to use.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
It is true. The reason that it is true is because of actually hundreds, if not thousands, of experiments that have been done in the hotshot laboratories all over the world. This evidence expresses itself in many categories. I've mentioned one already. The control laboratory clinical studies on remote healing, where people's thoughts can change biochemistry at a distance. It can change people's electroencephalograms, their brainwave tracings at a distance, even when the recipient doesn't know someone is intending that. We know that people's intentions can modify the growth rates of bacteria in test tubes. It can change the germination rate of seeds and spur the growth of seedlings after they've sprouted. So there's just an avalanche of data that's open to anybody who has the inclination to go there. The problem is that a lot of skeptics are horribly informed about what this data even looks like. And
so how can I'm sorry?
Let me mention one other aspect of how we know that thought can reach out at a distance. There are thousands of studies now in what we call remote viewing, where individuals can acquire information at arbitrary distances, even from the other side of the earth. So what we see in this new model of consciousness is that people can insert information into the world and change it, as in distant healing, or they can acquire information, they can get information at a distance, as in these experiments in remote viewing. But those are just two areas where we're on solid ground in saying that our thoughts can change the world.
So I want to ask one more question, and then we're going to go into the interesting different chapters in your book. But, many people say, oh, that really doesn't work because I think a thought all the time, like, I want to heal this or I want to do that or I want to get this car, I want to get this thing, and it doesn't happen. What can they do to be more successful in manipulating their reality?
Well, I think the most important things in life are not things. And I couldn't think of a worse way to prove whether or not your thoughts can change the world by basing it on what you can get. I think there are a lot more spiritually fundamental ways in which people can change the world than in acquiring a swimming pool or a second house or whatever. That's not my criteria for proving whether or not consciousness can change the world.
I totally get that. So let me rephrase just a little bit. Because we're kind of talking about two different things. One is evolving as a soul or being more spiritually aware, I guess. And the other would be maybe changing your health. So if somebody's sick and they want to get well, you can't just say, okay, I'm going to be well today. You have to, and I'm kind of pulling on heart math, you have to be cohesive and put forth the effort to get there. Is that right? Does that make better sense?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to state it. Many people who write about this have had different experiences in their journeys, their spiritual paths, and come up with different ways of looking at things. But one thing that has impressed me as a physician who's dealt with thousands of people sick and dying, and as well as living and thriving, is that there isn't any formula to acquire health or get rid of an illness once you've got it, or even to prevent one. And anybody who's looking for a surefire seven easy steps formula here is just usually going to be disappointed. It's not consistent with spiritual history to say that we can always think or pray our way into health, in my opinion. I wrote a book once about these issues called Healing Words, and the first chapter in it, I talked about how complex this is by going into the lives of some really spiritually advanced people and illustrate that many of them died from terrible diseases. So it isn't the case that if you become spiritually advanced, you're just automatically going to have great health. It just doesn't turn out that way. The Buddha died of food poisoning, for example.
Ramana, I didn't realize that.
Yes. Doesn't sound like a great way for a Buddha to go, but it's the fact. Ramana Maharshi, the most beloved science mystic in modern India, died a terrible, painful death of cancer. Bernadette at Lourdes, where all the healings and miracles are reported to occur, died a terrible death of either bone cancer or tuberculosis. It's hard to know which. So anybody who wants to say that if you become spiritual enough in advance, you're going to have smooth sailing, I think has their job cut out for them to prove that that's the case. I think it's a lot more complex than that even.
So I'd like to talk about, you mentioned in your book that consciousness or mind provides warning functions of mind to you.
Yeah.
Is there a relationship to synchronicities with that?
Well, I think there are. Synchronicities often occur when two people who are far apart have the same thoughts, the same feelings, and sometimes even the same physical symptoms. And remind me of what your first part of that question was.
The warning, you just talked to one of your captains about warning functions.
Exactly.
What is that?
Well, Dr. Larry Burke, who is an academic radiologist and an acquaintance and friend of mine, has a series now of 20 women who had dreams in which it was announced to them that they had breast cancer. And the warning in these dreams, in all of these cases, came from someone who was dear to them, who had died, a father or a mother or some other relative, and told them to get with it. You've got cancer. You need to get this checked out. And these stories, they're just jaw-droppers. In one case, a woman was told in her dream exactly where the breast cancer was. She went to her doctor. Now, the doctor did an exam and couldn't find a lump. So they did a mammogram, and it also was normal. And the doctor said, you know, you're just too concerned about this. We'll just watch this. And she said, no, this was the most vivid dream I've ever had in my life, and I want a breast biopsy. And he said, well, where will we biopsy? There's nothing to biopsy. So she took her finger and pointed to a specific place in her breast where it had been revealed to her in a dream where the cancer was. And so they did find a surgeon who was willing to go ahead with the biopsy, and it came back positive, and there was the cancer. But it was so tiny that they were able to excise it before it it spread, and so she's a healthy woman now. There are 20 cases like that. That's a survival function. That's a warning function that saved a woman's life.
I had something like that happen, but I didn't have a dream.
Uh-huh.
I kept hearing it auditorily that I had non-malignant uterine cancer.
Uh-huh.
And I was having all these horrible symptoms. I was bleeding, and I mean bleeding profusely like a stuck pig every day for months and months. I would have terrible pain. I'd go to the doctor, and the doctor did the sonar thing, and he did everything.
Yep.
And finally, he couldn't find anything. So finally I said, look, I don't care. And he thought I was crazy, by the way. I said, just get it out. I can't stand it anymore. So he took out my uterus, and a few days later, he called me and went, Eva, I got to tell you, you have non-malignant uterine cancer. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you have this thing called adenomyosis, and it's in between the uterine walls, so nothing I did would detect it.
Uh-huh.
But he thought I was crazy telling him that.
Well, that's a survival warning function, Eva, that, you know, you can add yourself to the cases.
So interesting. So here's...
I was just going to say, I had a patient once who was one of my dearest patients. She was a famous attorney in Dallas, and she had a dream one night, and she said, I saw in this dream that I had three little white spots on my left ovary. And she says, I'm fearful that it's cancer, and I want it checked out now. Well, her examination was normal, so we went ahead with the sonogram, and the sonogram is exactly as she described it. She had three little white spots on her left ovary. They weren't causing any kind of symptoms whatsoever. And she was fortunate, however, because she, although she got the appearance of it correct, she got her diagnosis wrong, and it wasn't cancer. It was just ovarian cysts. But there are millions of these kinds of cases where people seem to connect outside themselves beyond what their senses could reveal to them. And sometimes the information, as I've said, comes to them by uniting via a common consciousness with someone who has passed, who is deceased, who compassionately warns them that they need to do something, and take action. So those are one-mind examples.
You state some information according to Ralph Abraham that I thought was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Chaos deficiency happens at societal and global levels. What does this mean to us? He said he maintains that thick, frothy, fractal boundaries are prerequisite for stability and longevity of culture or health of people. What does that mean?
Well, when things come together that are different and they sort of bump into each other, they sometimes create patterns that are called fractals, which are patterns that the more you amplify and magnify what's going on, the pattern persists, even though you cone down at increasing degrees of smallness. You know, if we went into the details of fractals, I'm afraid everybody would just hang up. So I'm not going to do that.
You can just tell us what it means to our lives.
Well, chaos is important in people's lives. And the greater, we don't want chaos. It's not natural to want chaos, but that's the way life works. And what Abraham is trying to say that if we have chaos, then that creates an opportunity in our consciousness for extraordinary levels of communication to occur. Where this becomes important, in his view, is that when people can't experience a little chaos in their thinking, they develop intensely concrete walls that cannot be penetrated by any kind of thought or cross consciousness in terms of, say, our preconscious, our subconscious, and our conscious awareness, and things develop that are not very nice, such as multiple personality syndromes, where the different parts of our mind cannot communicate with one another. If there was this thick, frothy zone that he calls fractals, then this cross-communication would happen, be more likely to happen, and we would have an integrated personality. So we can pay a huge price for the lack of chaos. And when he describes dischaos syndrome, that's what he's talking about.
So could you talk to us a little bit about many of the wonderful examples that you've given in your book about mind as it relates to twins, or mind as it relates to communicating, or to near-death experiences, or the fact that whether or not there's continuance of existence?
Sure. Well, I love the chapter in One Mind book on twins, because I happen to be an identical twin. And all my life, my twin brother and I have had experiences that aren't supposed to happen. We've shared thoughts at a distance. We've shared physical symptoms at a distance when there was no possible sensory mechanism to explain how these things happen. Now, he and I are not special. About 20% of identical twins report this same sort of thing. In the book, I talk about some real whoppers that just are jaw-dropping, and I'll just relate one to give you an idea about what this looks like. This happened to a set of identical twin girls who were 4 years old, and one day the father took one of these little girls off to visit their grandparents. The other little girl wanted to stay home and help her mother with chores, which she did, but unfortunately she placed her hand on a red-hot iron and immediately erupted in a second-degree burn, a big, huge blister. And as it turned out, at the same time, tens of miles away, her identical twin sister erupted also in a second-degree burn on the same hand, the same pattern. She was taken to a doctor. These things were photographed, and they were investigated. And there you have it. I mean, there's nothing in modern science or biology or psychiatry that can explain this sort of thing. These things are a dime a dozen. If you look at the literature, there are hundreds of these sorts of examples. And they show us that there's some unitary, connective element that can bridge a separation in space and connect people's minds up. So, yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
So that's just one example, which is dear to me because of my own twinship with my brother. Besides that, I'm married to a twin. My wife, Barbara, and her twin brother have had these sorts of symptoms all their life. So I think that this is dramatic evidence that something connects people across space and time. These things are usually ignored even because people don't want to talk about them who are skeptical of this sort of thing. But they're there. They're not going to go away, and there's certainly a lot of them out there.
It that story makes me think of something else. You know Susan Kolb, don't you?
I do.
Susan Kolb, she's my best friend. And do you know Stanislav Ojak by any chance?
I'm afraid I don't know.
he was the guy that worked with Bill Tiller and did all that photography back in the 70s, you know, where things would show up every time he held the camera.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's a friend that I met at ISEAM years ago, and one day, Susan, she was also my neighbor, and she would come to dinner every night because she was single and I cooked every night. And she called and said, I'm on my way, and I was standing there cooking. And when she got there, before she got there, I cut my finger really badly. And so when she walked in, she said, what happened to your finger? And I said, oh, I cut it. And she goes, look, I was sitting at my desk returning phone calls to patients, and all of a sudden my finger just split open and blood started dripping off. And it was in the exact place at the exact same angle as my cut. And then Stanislav called me, and he's in Wyoming, and I'm in Atlanta. And I never talked to him, maybe once or twice a year. And he called me and said, "Was just I want to say hello." And he said, you know, the weirdest thing happened to me. My finger slid open tonight.
Well,
What would make that connection? And what chooses the connection there?
Well, that's a triple. I just told you a double with these identical twins, but that one, that's a good one. I would have used that in my book if I had known about it.
What's the chooser?
We don't know. I don't think that it's possible for science to have any hope currently of explaining that sort of thing. When I talk about the one mind, I think that that is a helpful model because it permits minds to share things at a distance. So it helps us point in the right direction, I should say.
Yeah.
But as far as the chemistry and the anatomy and all of this, no one has a clue about it. It happens.
Yeah, I can understand. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I can understand how it would connect to me and Susan because she bought the knife set for me that I was using when I cut myself, and she's a hand surgeon, and she's my best friend. But Stanislav, I mean, he's 86 years old, lives on the other side of the country, and I rarely get to talk to him.
So well, that's one for the books.
Yeah, it's just an interesting choice. Anyway. So talk about some about Sheldrake's work, swarm intelligence and group minds, and even some of the stories like the dolphin protecting the man or the beach 12 story. I just thought those were amazing.
Well, Rupert Sheldrake is a Cambridge-trained biologist in Britain who has for 30 years been interested in how people can communicate at a distance, not just with other humans, but with non-humans, other species. His particular interest is dogs, who seem to know when their owners make a decision to begin to return home from wherever they are, whether it's work or somewhere else. He has done videos of both the owner and the dog simultaneously, and statistically speaking, dogs have this uncanny ability to know when the owner has made a decision to leave where he is and return home. The dogs will go to the door and stand and wait. They will go to the window and look out patiently. And this has been confirmed in other studies, not just by Sheldrake, but by other specialists in animal behavior. So what do you do with something like that? We're faced with saying it's fraud or somebody's making it up or it's bad science, or we can engage it seriously and try to understand how such a thing might happen. It isn't just dogs and their owners. There's cross-communication among species. When people have looked at other entities in the biological world, particularly when we look at groups of animals, such as flocks of birds, such as starlings, for example, which can form what are called murmurations, and they turn, thousands of birds turn instantly in the same way. There simply isn't any time for any sensory signal to give them a cue to do that. They seem to be possessed of some sort of group consciousness, group mind, if you will, where they all can understand what to do at the same time. You see these same sort of spontaneous demonstrations in the behavior of fish, particularly when they're attacked. Schools of fish are attacked by predators, such as sharks, for example. So you see this also in large animals. The greatest example, which used to exist in our country, were the great American bison, the buffalo, who would wheel on a dime in the same direction as if they're possessed by some sort of consciousness that permeates all of the members of the group, the herd. You see it also in the caribou who live on the North Slope in Alaska. These have been videoed, and I report in the book a group, a man and a woman, who actually lived and followed these animals for months. And the videos are absolutely compelling. Most people think that animals behave that way because, you know, they're just like dominoes, a string of dominoes. One falls, and it nudges on the other, and it just keeps going on down the line. But this is not what these ethologists see. They see group behavior that's spontaneous and simultaneous. So we have a lot of examples, not just in people, for this distant unified communication between entities, but in animals as well.
Can you tell a couple of your stories? I just found them fascinating, the whales and the dolphins and the bees.
Well, I love the bees. There's a lot of talk about bees these days because they're dying off. Back in the 1800s and persisting even to the present day, there was a way of thinking about how bees are connected with their owners, and this custom was called telling the bees. Basically, it meant that when the owner of the beehive died, you had to inform the bees that their owner had died. Otherwise, they would just leave the hives and go somewhere else, and all the bee colonies would be lost. And there are stories where this has happened so reliably, time after time, that it makes you wonder what sort of communication a bee and a human can have. There are stories where the bees came into the church where the coffin was laid, and the bees hovered around the coffin and then exited the church. These are uncanny. I know of no particular experimental evidence where this has been put to the test, but it's one of those charming stories which suggests that humans and other sorts of creatures do have some sort of intimate contact. So I don't put that in the same category as some of the other hard science studies that I talked about in the book, but it's one that I find particularly interesting.
Do you think animals are aware that they exist?
Well, yes, I do. I don't think that there's any solid reason to suggest that that consciousness is the sole possession of human beings. I just can't go there. I think every dog lover and cat lover would probably with that.
Do you think they, if when they're laying there, look on your porch, you know, waiting, do they think about themselves?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how to even test that. But there is such an intimacy that develops between pet owners, particularly dogs and cats, that I know many pet owners who just get their backs up if you suggest that their animals aren't if they don't possess a high level of consciousness. There's a quotation in the book from Mark Twain. Someone got into an argument with him once, and the person said, "Dogs never go to heaven. That's impossible." And so Twain said, "Well, they may not, but if they don't go to heaven, I want to go where they go."
Me too. That would be my heaven. My dog's my child. Let's see. What was another one? I'd like to talk about afterlife reincarnation, but I also see if you have. I don't remember seeing this in your book, but I wanted to see if you had an opinion on suicide. And the reason I ask this is because I'm a thinker, so I think about consciousness and life lessons and stuff. And you know, I think on one hand, you know, I think it's a negative thing, but on the other hand, I think in order for awareness and information to grow, then it has to experience everything that is, and how would it know that if it didn't get to experience it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I like it. Yeah.
So what do you have a perspective on that?
Well, I think that there are various forms of suicide. I've known many patients in my life as a physician who took their own life because they got to a point in their life where the quality of their life was so horrible and miserable and painful that they felt that it was time to go. And then there are other people who kill themselves for, you know, just a million different kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with that scenario. So I suppose we'll all find out sooner or later the answers to your question, but I don't really have one. I have not put suicide under my microscope and made an elegant study of it. I do, however, think that the information from children who remember previous lives, or say they do, and then when they're checked out, their memories from a previous life are right there, and they are confirmed. I think that I agree with Dr. Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker and Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia that this is extremely convincing evidence of reincarnation. So I think that the evidence that our consciousness does not perish with the death of the body is extremely strong. That's how I line up on that. And I know that many Americans agree. There have been now an estimated 15 million Americans who have had near-death experiences where they see the other side, they say, and come back with such a strong impression of this that they're fully transformed in how they live their life. Having passed through the eye of that needle, they can't go back again. So I think that this is some of the best information that we're going to get on this side about the continuation of consciousness following physical death.
I think it's like riding a bike. You know, once it happens, you can't forget it. You can't go back. You can't forget how to do it. Why would you want to? You know, why would you want to forget it? So we have about, I don't know, 15, 18 minutes, and you have so much information. I would like to give you the opportunity to talk about whatever you would like to talk about.
Well, one of the things that I am fascinated by in terms of the one mind is the implications of a common consciousness for creativity and the gaining of wisdom. A lot of people, such as William James and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Aldous Huxley in the 20th century, have talked about a common pool of wisdom that's available to us if everybody's mind in some sense connects. You can think of it as a depot for information that's all the information that's ever been known or maybe will be known if minds do come together outside the constraints of space and time. And the trick then would be to tap into that pool of wisdom and come back with something that's helpful. This has been done an extraordinary number of times in my judgment. One of the people who favored this possibility of gaining information from outside yourself from a common source of wisdom was Thomas Alva Edison, the great American inventor. He gave us the moving picture machine, the phonograph, and the electric light bulb, and a bunch of other things. And I quote him in the book. He says, "People say I have created things. I have never created anything," which is sort of a jaw-dropper coming from Edison. But he said, "I get impressions from the universe." He said, "Things come to me from the outside." And this horrified a lot of people who wanted, you know, to just say that Edison, like Einstein, had a fabulous brain and he was a great thinker and he produced all this stuff through his own mental processes, but he said something entirely different. What he was saying is that he was able to access the source of information and put it to practical use. There have been a lot of people who echoed Edison in science. I talk about a lot of them in the book, but I think that's something that we underestimate. You know, we have this idea that we've got to go to university and become expert in math or physics or something. Otherwise, you know, we're not going to be worth much and we're never going to be creative. But if you look at the testimonies of a lot of these people like Edison, they say something entirely different. They're hooked into something bigger than themselves, a source of wisdom that exceeds their own. And I I think we see this played out often in the lives of children. In the book, I talk about Joseph Chilton Pierce, who wrote some fabulous books about spiritual development and psychology back in the 80s and 90s. And when he was teaching as a young professor in university in his 30s, he was obsessed, as he says, with the relationship between God and human beings. And he was reading a lot about Carl Jung's theories at that time. And one morning, while he was sitting on his bed preparing to give an early morning lecture, his five-year-old son came in and sat down on the bed and gave him a 20-minute lecture. A 20-minute lecture, he says, on this problem he was trying to deal with, how human beings are related to the Almighty or to the Absolute. He said his son spoke in complex, complete sentences. They were publishable. No one would have had to edit them. He said, he told me everything there was to know about the subject. And he said, the hair stood on my neck, and I broke out in a sweat, and I began to weep. He said he knew that he was in the presence of the uncanny, that he was witnessing something miraculous. And the little boy's ride came to kindergarten. The horn honked, and he got up and left and went on and had no recollection of any of this.
Oh, my, that's a beautiful story.
But it shook Pierce to his core, and he says that it would be another 20 years when he was in his 50s involved in deep spiritual work before he would ever come anywhere close to understanding what his five-year-old had revealed to him in that 20-minute period. So
that's just amazing.
Well, it is. Where do these kids come up with this stuff? I'm not saying that this is very common, but it happens, and we ought to try to come to terms with it. My way of coming to terms with it is to propose a model in which minds can come together in some dimension and this information can be shared.
I want to ask you something. You're talking about earlier how people can get this, and I don't remember exactly how you worded it, but now that you're talking about this, when I get my connection, whatever you want to call that thing.
Yep.
Whatever you want to call that thing. I've noticed that the creativity, I can distinguish the big mind from the little mind because the creativity drops in into the top of my head.
Yep.
And the mind chatter runs across my forehead.
Uh-huh.
Like left to right kind of thing, like a
right.
Stock market ticker tape.
Right.
So can you share any information that you have to people to help them better understand how to differentiate so that they might can better utilize information or recognize information that they get? How do they distinguish between the two?
Well, I think we'd all like to be able to be like Joseph Chilton Pierce's five-year-old,
yeah.
Where, you know, we tap into something that is just unlimited. And the question for me is, how do we access that? You know, you have cues, bodily cues and sensations that tend to tell you when you're on the right track. A lot of people have that. And but let's just suppose that you're starting afresh and people have never had an experience like this. How would they engineer it, or how would they help access this? And I think that the main problem is that we try too hard. And what I mean by this is that this ability to understand and sense and really know at a deep heart level that we are part of something beyond ourselves is just ingrained in us. We come hardwired with this. I mean, this is part of our original equipment. We do not have to make this happen. It is who we are. It is part of our birthright. And I think people develop this idea that this is something exotic, and that you've got to work your fanny off, or you're never going to know this. You're never going to experience it. And I don't think that's right. If you look at the literature of epiphanies, where people have these sparkling, majestic spiritual experiences in which they feel as if they're one with everything, and all of this is marinated in a feeling of deep love, these things just happen to people often out of the blue when they are not doing anything in particular. They may be washing dishes or working in the garden or just reading something mindless. The key, I think, in all of these sorts of experiences is getting our conscious waking awareness and our logical mind out of the way so that these experiences can surface and be real to us. And if you look at all of the time-honored ways of understanding this process, a lot of it has to do with putting the conscious mind to rest. That's why meditation is such a powerful tool and waking to this awareness. And so I want to emphasize the fact that you can't manipulate this. I mean, this is one of those things in life that sort of does us. We don't do it. And when this happens, it's perceived as a grace and as a tremendous blessing. So I would just say to people, don't try too hard. I mean, this is something that belongs to you, and you need to own it. And so the trick is getting our logical, rational minds out of the way. And when we do, we may be surprised about what happens.
We have 6 or 8 minutes, and the next question was just about what you just said, really, the law of reverse effort.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
I love this term. It belongs to Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World and a lot of those books we read in college English classes. Huxley wrote a book called The Perennial Philosophy, in which he talked about these one-mind type of experiences, and he was extremely focused on this idea that consciousness extends beyond individuals and unites in some plane. And so he was talking about how you get there. How do you know this? How can you experience it? And he said exactly what I said, because many of my opinions have been shaped by his, and he just said there is a law of reversed effort here, and the harder you try, the less it's going to be likely you're going to achieve it. The harder you go after it, the farther it recedes from you. So it was like surrendering, not in any totally passive sense of giving up, not that sort of surrender, but putting your own efforts out of the way and letting this bubble up from some deep place in you.
So that makes me think that you were talking earlier about things and creating or manipulating reality to create things, but really, if we live in a hologram, which I personally think that we do, that means that matter doesn't really exist on the physical level or at all, and that everything is really perspective of how you view it. Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, I think the world is largely what we... let me put it another way. I think the world, that the way it presents itself to us, is hugely influenced by what we think of it. I mean, that may seem like California woo to a lot of people, but I would suggest that they read a little bit about the attitudes of some of the founding fathers and mothers of modern physics. One of the people who has been inspirational for me on your particular question was the great physicist Max Planck, who said, consciousness is everything. You cannot get behind consciousness. And so this is one of the clearest clarion expressions of this idea that consciousness really matters. And I would say this, when people say that, you know, well, they don't want to talk about this consciousness stuff because that's too diaphanous and flimsy and ghostly, they want to talk about matter because matter is all that matters in their philosophy. Well, the thing is, we know now, since scientists have discovered something called dark energy and dark matter, the reason it's called dark is we don't have a clue about what it is. And this comprises about 95% of the so-called energy and matter in the universe. So if people want to hang their hat on matter, I'd say good luck. But it's just not clear about what it is they're even talking about when they want to go with matter.
I've interviewed a lot of physicists about that, and every single one of them says, you know, no, there's no such thing as matter. So we got 3 or 4 minutes. Is there anything you want to talk about?
Yeah, let's talk about immortality. You know, I've written this book where all of these fabulous experiences well up in people's lives and make them really happier and healthier and more creative and even wiser. And that's some of the real benefits of entering into this space where we know that we're connected with everything. But those are kind of the rewards on this side of life. I think the biggest payoff for the idea of the one mind is immortality. And the way that works, in my thinking, is that all of the presentiment experiments and the remote viewing experiments and many kinds of experiments that we haven't even talked about point to a picture of consciousness like this. Consciousness is infinite in space. It's infinite in time. And so if you think about what is meant by that, you come up with immortality. And the reason is this. If something is infinite in time, that means it's everywhere in time. It has no beginning, and it has no ending. All of our primary data these days in the experiments that I've alluded to point to this factor of consciousness. These studies point like an arrow to an eternal, immortal aspect of who we are. I think we ought to bite the bullet even and just call this the soul. That's the idea that has been most recognizable by people throughout history. So what we are doing by exploring the new information and data is to reinvent the soul. And I find it quite odd because science has always been accused of being the enemy of spirituality and things like the soul. But now we're seeing that, oddly, it's sort of shooting itself in the foot and coming up with information that supports the soul.
I just love it.
I think that's where we are, you know. I mean, this is such a great time to be alive and working in the field of consciousness because we're seeing science and spirituality come together.
We got 3 minutes, and this is how we're going to end. But I want you to take, you know, 15 seconds and give your website again before we get through, okay?
Yeah.
So if there's no matter on the quantum level, and we know that there's this thing, consciousness, gosh, I guess I'll just bite the bullet and say it. What is the role of, where's the higher power? Are we that thing?
Yeah, well, that's a fantastic question, and this conversation should go there because I think there's no way to avoid the question of whether or not the one mind is God. You know, this really gets a lot of people bent out of shape because if you give a yes answer to that, they'll say, well, that's the most blasphemous and heretical thing I've ever heard of. And, you know, we used to burn people at the stake for claiming to be God, and here you are trying to do this number on us again in the modern era. But there are different ways to understand this. One of the metaphors that's been used throughout history is the relationship between a drop of ocean water and the entire ocean. You know, the drop of water is the same as the ocean. I mean, it's H2O and with salt mixed in it. So you can say that a drop of ocean water is the same thing as the ocean. But we have to say, whoa, you know, you can go too far with this. Certainly the ocean is more powerful, it's more extensive, and it's probably a lot more important than the individual drop of water. So in one sense, the drop of water is the same thing as the ocean, but in another larger sense, it isn't. And so just because we say that we have divine qualities, such as a soul that's immortal and eternal, and we can't be limited, we're omnipresent as well, those are terms we've always attributed to God, but just because we share qualities with the Almighty doesn't mean that we are God. So there's still a way, I think, which we're separate from the Almighty, but there are other ways in which we share qualities, and those are the qualities that I want to emphasize by speaking about the importance of the one mind.
Where can we find you, Larry?
You can find me at my website, www.larrydossiemd.com.
You're the best. Thank you. Always so glad to have you.
Well, thank you. It's easy to talk to you, Eva. Best wishes to you.
Thank you. And have a happy holiday.
You too, my dear.
Good night.
Bye.